person who is with us today to make this presentation is Patrick Jackson, who is senior counsel with Jackson Jackson and Associates, which is an international public relations counseling firm which specializes in attitude change, reinforcement on social and organizational issues, and a variety of other topics as well. Pat's clients are throughout the United States. He founded the firm in 1956, and it's headquartered in Exeter, isn't it? Exeter, New Hampshire, which is someplace I've never visited, but it certainly sounds like an interesting place. Are you still with the blueberry farm? Pat's office is in a farmhouse, and he has a blueberry farm associated with it, so he's a man of many talents. He's a trustee of Antioch College, where he's also chairman of the Development and Communications Committee. He has many, many professional articles he's published. He's delivered speeches and lectures to a wide variety of organizations. He's been honored all over the country for his activities in the communications field. I first encountered Pat when he came to Omaha to make a presentation to the Public Relations Society of America chapter there, because Pat at that time was the president of the national organization. And I might add that the organization fared very well under Pat's presidency at that time. Without any further remarks, I'd like to introduce to you Pat Jackson and the subject of dealing with crisis.
That beats the introduction I got the other day when it was a lawyer who was doing it, and he said, now I would like to present our alleged speaker. It's interesting how those of us responsible for raising the funds are in a kind of a dilemma when it comes to the question of organizational crisis. Because organizational crisis essentially is involved with the relationship, the public relationship with the organization. Let's be very honest with one another. We still have a style in Turkey between development and public relations. Our whole point is very important. I thought we would have spoken to an NFL chapter about 3 months ago. And I was saying how wonderful it was because then we merged and it working together. And then, of course, 15 people came up to me afterwards with the usual stories about who we went getting along. So, for the moment, let's just assume, however, that here we are, responsible for things the organization raises funds, and yet another area of the organization operates and fails to do things, and eventually is a failure, it absolutely cuts us off at the pass. What does this do to us wearing our fundraising hat? It seems to me the thing it does to us is what always happens to people who can be harmed by a situation but may not have the organizational posture at the moment because of who reports to whom or whatever to do anything about it. It ought to make us into missionaries in any organization. It ought to make us look out for our own self-interest, just in our own sphere, and go to the organization and say, look, today we know how to deal with issues and crises. And maybe, since it's going to affect me, I better take the responsibility to bring up the subject. Ed and I were talking here just at the start of this session, and he shared with me a clipping of what happened, for example, to the Omaha History Museum. It had a 2 7/10 million grant coming to it from the Peter Kiewit Foundation, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, the foundation hears that there are some financial difficulties, maybe, some accounting that wasn't quite right in this organization, and so bingo, they immediately withdraw all funds, make an issue, in fact, of the funding and the fund accounting of this museum. And so here's a group that has raised some funds, is continuing to raise more. I don't imagine they're going to get many donations this year. They've got a major problem. More and more we're running into that. I want to share with you basically 4 points. First of all, I want to emphasize as much as I can that management of anything today, I don't care if you're managing fundraising or an organization per se, management of anything today has to include the anticipation of issues. And the reason it does, at least in North America, is just because of our basic system. We operate under the court of public opinion, better known as democracy. And in the court of public opinion, anybody and everybody does have the right, even the responsibility, to say what they feel about some issue of public interest. And so therefore, anybody running anything that is trying along, thinking they won't run into a crisis or a hot issue, is really a bad manager. And if you need any examples, just pick up the paper any day, because you know better than I the pantheon of organizations who are stalled today, bogged down, sometimes almost going
out of existence because of those crises. The second point I want to make is that most crises in organizations begin in the daily routine operations of those organizations. We have allowed ourselves to build up this picture of a crisis as something that's brought in by some activist group, you know, from New Jersey. Those crises begin 90% of the time right with us, right inside our daily operations. Thirdly, issues and crises, however, are not just problems. They may give you the best opportunity you will ever have to become known, to really get your policies out there, and to follow that up with significant fundraising. And finally, an emergency plan is essential for every organization today. If my first point is correct, that anticipating issues is necessary, then clearly a plan to do that is also necessary. We know a lot about that kind of plan. But let me share with you first the four areas in which we know issues arise and where we are the party to create them, because we've got a lot of data on this. One area where they arise is an irresponsible policy. If we're going to anticipate issues, we've got to know where they come from. The second place, as I said, is in daily operations, the things you normally do in an organization. The third is poor response strategy. When we get in a situation like this museum that I described, management doesn't know how to respond to that. They respond in the old traditional ways, which just make it worse, as I'll explain. And the fourth is just simple failure to do what we call issue anticipation. 90%, however, come right there. Now, often, I should really say, come very there, because it may be an operational issue, but when it comes up, we respond to it in a way that is only going to make it worse. If you want to start a plan, if you want to look at the areas where you're apt to get into trouble, that's the place to look. We can't even talk about putting together a plan, however, to deal with it. Until we spend a little bit of time thinking about what we know about public relationships. Now, notice what I said, public relationships. I'm not talking about the techniques of the field of public relations. And there are obviously the options of them, techniques of the field of public relationships. But I'm truly talking about what do we know from the behavioral sciences about relationships, how they're built, how they're maintained, and so forth. Now, I can see you all sitting back there saying, oh my God, I'm a fundraiser. Now this guy is telling me I have to learn all about public relationships. Well, I know it's unfair. I remember, in my little New England town, the Catholic Church plays bingo in Latin, so us Protestants can't win. So do not expect fairness. The first and maybe major factor, and you should know this already, is fundraisers, is whether or not you think those are important. If you think those are deeply important, you're probably going to get into trouble if you're involved in an issue or a crisis. The fact of the matter is, humans don't give a damn about that. What people care about is something far less intellectual, logical, and cranial than that. People function not on facts, but on their perception. And so really, when we're talking about building public relationships or dealing with issues, we're essentially talking about managing perception, about helping to get people who don't know anything about the organization to have positive perceptions about dealing with people's misperceptions, about keeping the whole thing in a positive range. Now, perceptions are clearly and demonstrably the most powerful factor in human society. And you just got to think about it. Perceptions are nothing more than what Mother Nature gives to each of us as a kind of a shield around ourselves to be able to interact with the world around us, where often we don't know much about the situation. And so the perception of fear lets us draw analogy from what we do know about what's out there that we don't know. A baby, after all, was born into this world with nothing but a perceptual fear, and has to make all kinds of life decisions as it grows without real knowledge. And that
So, when we're dealing with issues, we need to know They're just throwing the information out there, even if it isn't fact, if it's perception, won't work. You've got to plug in humans, people, who can work the grapevine, who can spread the word of mouth, who are opinion leaders. We need that two-step flow. I'm telling you some of these things because I do approve that when we get into the planning process, they're necessary. One other thing, and that is that we do today have pretty much a science on these kind of activities. Granted, it's behavioral science. Behavioral science isn't as accurate as physical science. But then remember, biological science isn't as accurate as physical science either, and yet most of us tend to want our doctors to be scientific. So the things I'm going to share with you are based on a body of knowledge. And that body of knowledge begins with four basic rules, if you will, from the behavioral sciences. Now, those of you who are behavioral scientists know that there are no rules to the field, so obviously I have to arrogate to myself four rules. But take a look at these because I think they tell the story. The first is a rule of sociology, which is called the rule of abuse. And the theorem is any change in a relationship is the result of an abuse by one of the parties. Any change in a relationship results from an abuse by one of the parties. So that a crisis, an issue which besets an organization, is often seen as an abuse of them by many of the public of that organization. So how do they do that? Why do they do that to me? I've been telling everybody how great they are at the cocktail parties, and now they do this dumb thing, and it's all over 90 calories. Clients of the organization say, oh, I'm not sure. And I went there last week, you know, to the hospital, was it cured? And now I'm not sure. People feel abused. So the first rule here actually becomes the crisis. The other three rules are ways we solve the crisis. The psychologists have given us a couple of good rules. The first one is the rule of participation. People will only get behind those policies and organizations that they have had a voice in formulating. Now, we all know that from our personal opinion. We don't want people just laying policies on us. We want to be involved. I don't have to tell fundraisers about participation. You wrote the book. But it's an important rule in dealing with issues. Another rule from psychology is the rule of reward. When an issue hits an organization, everybody is called on to do a little extra, to do a little more. And then when it all goes away, somehow the organization usually seems to forget that. Furthermore, when an organization is involved in a crisis, there are public out there that have been supporting that organization, and now we have paid their reward, and it may suddenly be a social punishment rather than a social reward to be a friend of, a member of, a spokesperson for that organization. So we need to remember that we've got to keep those rewards strong. Attention is rewarded during the period of crisis. Finally, there's a rule from anthropology that is really at the heart of this whole business, and that is the rule of the cheerleader. The anthropologist tells us there has never been a successful society or a successful organization that did not have near its center someone that in modern society we would call a cheerleader. The kind that when everything was going to hell, to go out and slap people on the back and cheer them up and say we can do it, and when things are going good, they're the kind to go around and say we can even do that. We've got to push a little harder. So think about some of these things as a backdrop. And now let's tear in and take a pretty sharp look at this whole crisis. First, we need to ask ourselves, what is a crisis? And I think there's been a lot of misunderstanding about that. A crisis, essentially, is an issue that got out of hand. Now, an issue has at least three characteristics that we're pretty sure of. First of all, it isn't really an issue worth bothering about, unless it affects large numbers of people, large in your context, whatever that may be in the situation. Secondly, you've got to have at least two opposing sides. You know, every idea has another idea that is going to counter. It was nice when society was like that. Now, usually, you have two opposing sides on every issue. It's one of those people you have to contend with. There's got to be at least two opposing sides, and it's got to be an emotionally charged subject. How many people can really get into it? It isn't even right to call it an issue unless it has those characteristics. Now, when a crisis arises, just to differentiate for you, because I think issues are even more important than crises, clearly, so that we can deal with issues, they may not become crises. A crisis, remember, is an issue that got out of hand. It has these characteristics and it got away from us. A crisis, generally, technically, is a turning point in the organization, something that really is potentially damaging. Sometimes it's a life or death struggle or conflict. And usually it has a sense of anxiety and dread, and now it's not just opposing sides, it's a real adversarial situation. So realistically, without trying to be a stargazer, how can you then anticipate where these issues are going to come from and then keep those issues from evolving into crisis? Well, let me share with you what we know. I should tell you, it's only fair, I think, for a speaker to tell the audience a little something about your experience with the subject, so you know my biases, you know whether I know anything or whether I just read a couple of things. But our firm, Jackson Wagner, has been dealing with issues for all the 30 years of its existence. Many of the situations that established an organization, the corporations, are now rushing to embrace, frankly, new developments for the activist movement during the 60s and 70s, because during the 60s and 70s, if they were picking your outfit, they were probably a client of mine. Now that American managers have learned that you don't have to wait for that, that organizational change and renewal is coming from within, needless to say, our clients now are mostly large organizations. The activist movement at the moment is very dead. The point being simply, I have seen this personally from both sides of the fence, and what I want to share with you is from some pretty voluminous files of ours and from two newsletters that I published, including one you may know called Channel, which is the oldest publication for not-for-profit organizations in America, founded in 1923, and no, I did not found it in that year. The first thing we know is that we've got to categorize issues, or else we're going to treat them all alike. Here's how we categorize issues, in four categories. First, we talk about latent issues. Some scholar somewhere, some activist, or some dreamer has enunciated a situation which could be an issue for you, but it's just now starting out. If you went out on the street and asked people, nobody would have heard of it. You might read about it in a couple of years in a little magazine or a scholarly journal. Obviously, that's the time to capture issues and deal with them. Because if they get past that stage, then they become emerging issues. Now, if you go out on the corner and you ask people, you'll still get maybe 1%, 2% of the public, and maybe only 4 or 5% of knowledgeable opinions that don't even know about it. But still, you can see that in terms of diffusion across society, it's starting to make some headway. Again, we can still deal with it. If we don't deal with it in these two phases, we have got a serious problem, because the next phase is it becomes a hot current issue. And when that happens, you have lost. And the reason you have inevitably lost is that in our kind of a society, the only way we can resolve issues is with compromise. And so even if you were 100% right and the other view is 100% wrong, you know you're going to have to compromise to settle a darn thing. And so once it gets here, you've lost. And now this calls for something entirely different. Issue anticipation clearly won't work anymore. It's got to be crisis management. We used to think that's all there was. And then we began seeing another phenomenon. In the sense of issues that we call fallout issues, here's what happens. When we settle the hot issue, we say, that's over. It doesn't really go away, because some of the compromises we made left little unsolved topics here and there, and bingo, they come right back as fallout issues. And the worst part is, they don't have to go up and work their way through the cycle anymore. They can become hot issues almost immediately, because the general debate that put them on people's awareness agendas has already taken place. So the first thing is to take a look at that. Now, if you just look at these and then think for a minute about contemporary society, you'll see why I say every organization has to do some tracking like this if it all cares about its future. If you think about current political or media muckraking, for example, I mean, you know any little thing is going to get popped into an issue. If a local medium thinks it can sell some airtime or some newspapers, the politician sees the visibility in it or sees perhaps a platform, and and don't kid yourself. This is equally true in the not-for-profit organization. Today, we find more and more competitive pushing the issue. I don't know if you've been involved any of you in the hospital wars, the health care wars. We've been deeply into that. And it would be nice to think that all of us, you know, behind our wonderful models and all that, are treating our peers across town as colleagues. Forget that. We're treating other people that may take our markets. And so we ask, just like GM versus Ford. But when you have an issue, you also have to think, is the competition maybe keeping it going? They are. Don't worry about it. Just turn on it. They are. All right. So now we've got our issues anticipated here. But let's assume, bingo, we don't deal with them up here and we start getting a hot issue. It is inevitably going to come onto the agenda. The public is going to deal with it. The first step, clearly, is diagnosis. And what we've learned is that there are about five kinds of these crises. Actually, where I put hot issues, you could almost put crises. Because by the time it gets to that stage, it'll probably look like a crisis to you, even if a year later you may look back and say, well, that wasn't a crisis, that was just an issue. I don't think at the moment you give a damn. All you know is you're in the soup. So how can we diagnose this? Well, there are five kinds of crises. The first kind is organizational failure of some type. And just between you and me, it's rarely the workers and the employees. That's the Great American myth. Workers do that to get that and not just between you and me, but if you're looking for crisis, that's probably where you'll find most of your organizational failures. I mean, when the plant of Union Carbide in India and Bhopal had that problem, you know, it's nice to scapegoat the employee, but if you look into it, the company, in order to save money, merely cut out all safety inspectors. You know, they need to save some dough. I think they're sorry now, but it's a little bit. It's an organizational failure. The second kind is a simple disagreement. Where I come from, we started a thing called the Trust for New Hampshire Land in order to raise $60 million from various sources, including the government. State government, of course. Ronnie cut out all the federal money, but in any event, to save some significant land in our city. And everything's going along swimmingly, and suddenly up pops the senator from the city of Manchester and says, well, why are we doing all this for trees? We could be doing it for people. That's just a disagreement. You know, I mean, we've got a view, and our client has a view, but all of a sudden, see, what was just a nice little fundraising effort is now being talked about by people all over in terms of an issue, of a disagreement. We're all familiar with that. The third kind is what we call a bedfellow crisis. Somebody on the board or some officer does something on their own time or in some other context that seems to rub back off. I don't even think I have to tell you about that kind. You're all familiar with it. And then, of course, there are two scandals, usually involving sex and money. Those are the two major ethics, you know, is always talked about. People get all upset about ethics for getting it. If it has sex in it or money in it, you're in deep trouble. If it's ethics, you can probably take it over and go on from there. And I don't mean to sound cynical about that. It's just that I've just been through this so many times. So, you know, choose non-sexy executives and that kind of thing. There is a fifth kind. I almost want to put it up here like that because I don't want to mislead anybody. There are true accidents. Hospital that we were affiliated with was doing a wonderful remodeling, and they were remodeling on the west side of the